and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada's podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Host Pamela Ritchie welcomes institutional portfolio manager Elon Collette to the program. Elon is a new member of the Global Asset Allocation Team and works closely with Jeff Stein, David Wolf, and David Talk. On this episode, Elon provides context and an outlook on the Canadian economy and other countries to help understand what it all means in terms of opportunities in the market. Elon comments on inflation and if it's more structured or cyclical. He says public debt levels have risen globally and remain elevated. When debt is high, you can grow, cut, or inflate your way out. Inflating your way out tends to be the path of least resistance. And what does a rise in inflation mean for Canadian investors? Elon says in the funds, there is tactical overweight to asset classes that do well in these types of situations. He believes these protective asset classes are the right insurance to have. Elon also touches upon emerging markets, the housing market in Canada, and advancements in technology. This podcast was recorded on March 26, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada, ULC, or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Elon, I am just going to kind of begin with exactly how your role is finding its way right now. Now and over the months to come, you're new to the role. Tell us a bit about how you will be doing things.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I joined the Canadian team at the start of this year after spending 6.5 years as a researcher on our asset allocation research team. And in the role that I have right now, I am going to be the primary liaison between David Wolf, David Talk, and Jeff Stein, and a lot of people on this call, and the contacts that they have within Fidelity. And so I'm the, I guess, unfortunately for them, the face of the funds, if you will. And I look forward to that challenge. It's a very, very interesting role to have.
Well, see, it's great to see your face and meet you, because that's the role you're going to be taking. And let's go directly to sort of your depth of expertise on inflation. I mean, let's just begin there. The question, obviously, du jour is, are we going to see a more structural inflation over the years to come, or is what we're sitting in cyclical?
That's a really interesting question, and something that our team thinks about is really front and center for investors right now. So one of the things we do is we think about longer term secular issues. And, you know, the one that is sort of top of mind, I think, right now is debt and public debt levels. And this sort of sets up the inflation discussion. So public debt levels have risen really globally and are very, very elevated right now. And generally, when debt levels are very high, you have three ways out. You can grow your way out, you can cut your way out, or you can inflate your way out. And our view is that inflation is the path of least resistance. And that's intersecting a very, very different policy framework, if you will, monetary policy framework than anything we've observed in the last 25 or 30 years. So on inflation, cyclically, I would say inflation still will remain muted. There's still 9.5 million Americans out of work versus pre-COVID levels. So there's not about to be a move much higher in inflation, in my view. But over the medium term, those elevated levels of debt coupled with a very, very different policymaking objective sets up the case for a structural change in inflation.
Let's go to that policy goal, as you say there. How much of it, and we're talking really about the United States at the moment, how much of that is employment, unemployment at this stage? I mean, how crucial is that to really any other moves?
It's really critical. And so, backing up a little bit, we were told And while this does pertain to the U.S., I would say this is really a global move to a more permissive, if you will, inflation framework or monetary policy framework. We were told last August at their conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, that periods of weak inflation would be met with periods of higher inflation, such that inflation over some unspecified horizon would resemble the Fed's targets. And the other thing they did in revising this was, I think, move to a more holistic view of the labor market. So gone are the days when we can just look at the unemployment rate and read everything we need to know about the labor market. We should be looking at a broad spectrum of indicators, various measures of unemployment across demographics, across age groups, across education levels, number one. And number two, we should look at a more holistic set of labor market engagement indicators. For example, participation rates and things like that.
Do you have sort of a favorite unemployment indicator or employment indicator? I'm always curious, you know, economists have certain things they gravitate towards. What do you like to look at the most?
Absolutely. I mean, I try to look at all of them holistically, but the one that always jumps to the top of my list is the employment to population ratio for the 25 to 54 year old, what they call prime age group. And just defining what that means, it's the number of people in that population, the 25 to 54 year olds, that are engaged and employed in the labor market. And pre-COVID, that number was over 80%, and it fell quite a bit and has recovered to around 76%. But for example, that's one way to measure that the healing in the labor market has really only just begun and has plenty of room to run before the enormous hole created by the COVID shock is really filled.
So we're going to come back to all of these different pieces of inflation and employment and where they all mean, but I just want to sort of get you to frame for us what this means for Canadian investors who are looking at all of these different things happening, dealing with various forms of volatility, and some call them sort of little asset bubbles that we're seeing here and there, plus the Canadian debt that is obviously being issued. How do you put this all in a framework for Canadians and sort of what they need exposure to make sure that they are as well diversified as they possibly can be?
Absolutely. And again, this comes back, I mean, probably many of my answers will come back to inflation, but this comes back to inflation first and foremost, I would say. So I mentioned elevated levels of public debt intersecting permissive policymakers sets up the risk for higher inflation in the medium term. And if we've identified that as a risk, the question is, how are we positioned for it? So in our funds, we have tactical overweights to asset classes that we believe do well in the event of unexpected changes in inflation, things like TIPS, real return bonds, as well as gold, which are proven to hedge unexpected changes in inflation well. And we're not talking about an inflation rate like we saw in the 80s. We could be talking about an inflation rate that has averaged 1.7% for the last 25 years, perhaps becoming 2.5%. And the reason we care, I mean, which is a critical question, why do we have these positions? Why should we care? The reason we care is inflation is the poison, if you will, for a 60-40 portfolio. It messes up that correlation that we know and love. When bonds protect you in periods of stress, with inflation, you know, that correlation, if you will, really gets messed up in a 60-40. And the case in point is the 80s, when inflation was really cooking, you really had nowhere to hide, and commodities were largely uninvestable in the 80s as well. So we believe that this is the right insurance to own right now in our portfolios, really to inoculate, if you will, perhaps a bad pun, but inoculate the portfolios against this inflation risk.
So bring us to the Canadian dollar, where it's been sitting, again, where the people listening to you right now, you know, probably have most of their money in Canadian funds. And then bring in sort of the EM part of it. We've heard David Wolf talk a fair amount about exposure to EM. It has to do with the Canadian dollar. It has to do with our economy versus others. Set that up for us. It's been a rough week, actually, for EM, to be honest.
Sure. I mean, this is a really important position in our portfolios. And I think it relates to really an underlying core view that we have across our portfolios, which is of a robust, coordinated global reopening, right? So we really believe that that is the sort of one of the touchstones, if you will, or cornerstones of the positioning, that we will see a robust and global reopening. And while that will lift a lot of boats, I mean, you can make the argument that it will even lift Canada's boat, we think it will lift EM boats even more. EM, we believe, has a higher sensitivity or beta, if you will, to that reopening narrative without having some of the debt problems that Canada has. So, you know, Canada came into this this COVID recession with some debt vulnerabilities on the private side, and then heaped on debt vulnerabilities from the public side. And with EM, you can still get this cyclical exposure, this pro-cyclical exposure, but without some of the debt issues. And as you mentioned, this also relates to our Canadian dollar positioning. You know, the underweight that we have to Canada is also reflected in that Canadian dollar underweight, and that the EM exposure takes some of that Canadian dollar exposure away.
There, it looks like that the Bank of Canada this week has signaled that it's willing. We mentioned it at the intro, is willing to slow down, get out of some of the asset purchase programs that it's been in. That in theory certainly could make the Canadian dollar rise. Give us your thoughts on what that announcement meant. It was more of a hint. It was a discussion. It was a framing. But what should we take away from that conversation this week from the Bank of Canada?
I mean, it was a very interesting move. It was interesting that it was not the governor who made the announcement.
Why is it interesting? What do you make of that? You used to work at the Bank of Canada.
Yes, and so I mean, the way I see that is, you know, TIFF really is a consensus builder, and you know, he will take the input from everyone around the table to build consensus. My view of that is really that that sort of delegation of that announcement to Deputy Governor Gravel, who has extensive market experience, is a signal that, you know, that there are many voices around the table. And so, you know, central bank communication is particularly important when rates don't have a lot of room to move. So I did find that interesting. And I think what it means is, you know, I don't think Canada, even with that announcement, I'm hesitant to say that Canada will lead the charge, if you will, on tightening up policy. You know, they may tweak some of the programs, but as you mentioned, the risk here is an elevated Canadian dollar. And, you know, the bank doesn't want a Canadian dollar sustainably above 80 cents. We've been waiting for a long time for this baton to pass away from housing and consumer spending to exports and productive investment. You know, that's historically the backbone of the Canadian economy. And productive investment raises standards of living. And too much of the growth in Canada has been housing. So, you know, a dollar, an appreciating Canadian dollar doesn't help that handoff towards exports. And so I sense that my sense is that the Bank of Canada will really not take the lead globally on this removal.
So was that just communicating elements of caution to the policy, just sort of telegraphing that there's caution here? But as you say, there's only so far it can be taken. Anyway, probably last question on the Bank of Canada, but I'm just curious because you're clearly the person to be asking.
Sure. Yeah, I think they are trying to telegraph sort of a clear and balanced view. They can't be dismissive of the progress that the economy has made, right? So Canadian employment fell by roughly 10-13% during the COVID shock, and it's only about 3% away from its pre-COVID level, right? So they can't be dismissive of the progress that has been made in the Canadian labor market, in the Canadian economy. The financial system is sound, and so they have to certainly flick at that. But in terms of being overly aggressive on the removal of stimulus, you know, that tightening in financial conditions would really, I think, unwelcome globally in terms of if I'm thinking it with a policymaking lens, if you will.
Right. Okay. Awful lot of discussion, Ilan, about housing, the housing market. I mean, it's always a favorite. And as you mentioned, in your opinion, we've been leaning too hard on it. In the opinion of a lot of people, we've been leaning too hard of it for you know, GDP, basically. But there does seem to be a heightened discussion right now. What should we read between these headlines? So how do you read them?
I mean, housing is a very interest rate sensitive sector. And so if you told me a year and a half ago, you know, that rates were going to decline tremendously, there was going to be a huge amount of income support, the natural thing to happen in an economy would be for housing to move higher. I mean, housing is a cyclically sensitive part of the economy. Our concern in Canada is it's really stunning, actually, the housing activity and just the share of growth in Canada that has been housing, right? So 10% of GDP right now is housing, or maybe 9%, but very close to 10%. And the numbers are really striking, right? So Canadians spend more on real estate commissions than the entire value of motor vehicle, auto and truck exports out of Canada, right? So,
wow.
I think what that speaks to is this imbalance in the Canadian economy. And from a portfolio position, what that means is the only way to really remedy this imbalance in the medium term is with a depreciation of the Canadian dollar, really to make the things that we sell to our neighbors more competitive, right? To change the price of them, if you will. A third of Canada's GDP historically has been exports. That's the historical backbone of the Canadian economy. And housing and debt-fueled consumer spending has crowded some of that out.
Well, let's go to trade, export, import. Let's go to this question of where Canada perhaps should be going, in your opinion, where it can be going from here. It obviously is very sensitive to the Canadian dollar, but you know, what needs to happen to push that forward? And, you know, do you see that happening, basically?
Right. I mean, this has been something that we have been waiting on for quite some time. You know, every Bank of Canada monetary policy report has their forecasts for the expected contribution of trade over the next few years. And we really haven't seen this handoff take place. And, you know, the thing, and the previous governor, Poloz, really spoke to this a lot, given his EDC background, that, you know, this is a transition that Canada really has to make for growth to be, sustainable is the wrong word, but for growth to be more than just housing and consumer spending. I mean, to be clear, consumer spending is critical. You know, for example, in the U.S., the U.S. consumer alone is the third largest economy in the world, just the consumer. And, you know, that will fuel the global reopening. But from Canada's perspective, Canada sort of needs to find its mojo in terms of what it can be competitively, globally, in terms of trade.
So it's interesting, this question rolling in right now from one of the investors fits pretty closely to what you're talking about. So self-driving cars, drones, new inventions could cut jobs. There is this whole discussion of technology and what it's going to do sort of to the demographic jobs picture. What kind of discussions does the GAA team have on the future of labor disruptions and also investments?
This is a really, really good question. We think about this a lot. The team I used to work on, the asset allocation research team, we had a dedicated secular analyst who just examined these sorts of things. And perhaps unsurprisingly, Pamela, I'm going to bring this discussion back to inflation a little bit. You know, so one of the ways we think about inflation is in terms of this Amazon effect or robots or automation, right? So you can make the argument, you can make two arguments coming out of the pandemic. You can say the workers at the low end of the wage scale or low end of the skill scale have higher bargaining power now because they've been, you know, they've proved themselves to be basically essential workers. And that increase in bargaining power will lead to higher wages, which will lead to higher service prices, which could push inflation higher. The counter to that is this that push higher in wages among more routine oriented jobs could increase the demand for automation and robotics from at the firm level. And if that were to be the case, you wouldn't necessarily see that upward pressure on wages coming from sort of the lower skilled part of the labor market.
Wait, just say that one more time again. Just stitch that together for us again.
Right. So just again, you know, I think there's sort of two sides to this discussion. The first side is low wage workers who maybe perform routine tasks have higher wage bargaining power coming out of the pandemic. They'll push their wages higher. The firms, instead of eating that cost, will push it onto the consumer, and that will push up service prices and inflation. The other side of that argument is increases in automation, right? So if anyone's been into sort of a fast food restaurant lately, they've probably noticed large kiosks. I mean, there is increased automation showing up in a lot of sectors that demand routine labor. And if that propensity to automate increases, you could certainly see, you know, an offset to some of that increase in inflation pressure. I mean, and this is something we've seen in quite a few of the sort of line items, if you will, in the inflation basket. I mean, we have seen the automation, the Amazon effect enter into quite a few of these components.
It's different, but it makes me think of the idea that with better technology, all of us with phones and better access, that we would get back more time. But of course, we don't. We're just more connected, which has been very helpful in the pandemic and, you know, and for a million different reasons. But it's not quite what we thought. You know what I mean?
That's right. I think, you know, if I'm being honest, the statistical agencies, I think, have a hard time taking on board some of these cost changes in terms of inflation and the statistics. So it's very, very easy to measure the price of something that's sold in a store. It's much more difficult to take that price and control it for the quality that we're receiving. You know, I joke that the best time to buy a washing machine is never, or the best time to buy a TV is never, because in terms of quality adjusted terms, that price is continually falling because of improvements.
That's so interesting. Yeah, well, there's lots of reasons to put that off. That is for sure. Okay, so I wanted to just get, I think we've hit a number of different areas. I think I'd love you to kind of sum up a couple of areas that we really need to just kind of keep in mind as we watch, you know, inflationary numbers roll through, get announced, Canada versus the U.S. We haven't really touched on ESG, and we also haven't really touched on the virus. And really, the vaccine program is what I'm talking about. I mean, at the moment, there seems to be a lot of discussion of the U.S. and other countries too pulling ahead because they have better vaccine programs, therefore they're back at it faster. Have things changed in your mind in terms of who reopens and gets there first in this sort of global recovery story? Have the players changed or shifted a little bit?
I mean, I think there has been some shifting. As we're all well aware, you know, the rollout in Canada of the vaccine has not been as quick as people had hoped for. Whereas in the U.S., it really depends on which state you're in. And of course, in Israel, I think everyone is vaccinated, or nearly everyone. I think there will be this mistiming, but taken as a whole, taking a step back, I think a robust global reopening is still the underlying narrative, perhaps with some nuance across countries in terms of timing. You know, so one of the major takeaways for me is really you should never short the U.S. consumer. Right. Like I mentioned, just the U.S. consumer alone is the third largest country in the world. If you stacked it against GDPs, it's almost as large as China's national GDP, just the U.S. consumer. And with the tremendous amount of income support, you know, stimulus checks, as well as that sort of pent up saving, we really, really do believe that pent up saving is going to be unleashed over the next 6 months to a year as that reopening narrative plays out. You know, so while I don't think all of us are going to be consuming, you know, two haircuts a week, I'm certain that there's some sort of pent up dining, travel, and leisure that will play out. And one last point I would mention on that. I mean, one of the reasons we have that EM overweight, that EM tactical position in our funds really relates again to the share of that those economies that are service related. So take, for example, Italy, which is, you know, an open air museum, if you will. GDP fell by 20% during the pandemic. That's twice as big of a hole than the US or Canada. And while it's come back, there's still almost a 10% hole in terms of GDP. So there's quite a bit of catch up still left in Italy. And we think that bounce will be quite large, which really explains that. I'm sorry, I said EM, I meant EFI, the overseas developed overweight position we have in the funds, that higher beta, if you will, to the reopening narrative.
I don't know about you, but almost everyone, if I ask someone where they'd like to travel, they all say Italy. So they're going to have a real lineup of services to provide. I think probably the world over.
Which means there's going to be long lines.
Long lines, exactly. I want to finish with inflation, but I want to also finish with ESG. And so I'm going to ask you whether ESG is in fact broadly, and obviously it's you know, it's a broad question, but does it become inflationary as we see? I mean, in Canada, they have approved on a national level. We see the courts say that carbon pricing on a national level is in fact fine. I mean, it does look like everything is moving in this direction. Does it cause inflation in your mind? Do you model for that?
That's a very interesting question. And, you know, there's a tremendous amount of ESG research happening inside Fidelity right now. And so the team that I would have been on, or I used to be on, would have certainly been attacking this question and examining it. I think, you know, is ESG inflationary? The question to think about there is, are these permanent price changes or one-time changes in the price level? And so, you know, I can make the case that it would be a one-time change in prices, but not necessarily change the trajectory of inflation over the longer term. I mean, it is going to be interesting to see, but my view is that it's not really the front and center concern for inflation right now. The biggest concerns to me around inflation are automation, demographics in the secular horizon, and then third, that really, really significant increase in debt levels and a change and a real sea change in monetary policy formation and just how quickly it's going to react. That is the one thing I can't stress enough, is we're in a different environment than we have.
We will be checking back with you on that front. And we're very glad to meet you, Ilan Colette. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks. So very glad to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. And don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again, and see you next time.